Good morning and welcome to Prairie, a liberal religious community. My name is Penny Eiler and I'm chairman of the program committee. Some of us are bringing our best selves to this space and some of us are bringing our struggling selves. All of us are welcome here and all of us are loved. Some of us already have open hearts and some of us aren't quite there yet, because our hearts have gotten a little beaten up this week, and we might have forgotten how to trust and open. Your heart is welcome here, no matter how bruised. We welcome you among us. All of us are imperfect, but we're here to drop our defenses and trust that what happens in worship is powerful and life-giving. Together, we affirm that this day, our being here together, can make each of us braver, more compassionate, and wiser than when we were when we woke up this morning. We welcome you here, people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we have a wide variety of services, so if you're new here, give us another try. You might be surprised. We have something different every week. Sometimes it's somebody from the wider community. Sometimes it's one of the members here. And sometimes it's our consulting minister, Sandy Ingham. This morning, we welcome a longtime Prairie friend, Robin Carey, and he will share his daughter's adoption story. For opening words this morning, we'd like to invite up Barb and Ron Fry.
The opening words come from Isabella Rossellini. Says, adoption carries the added dimension of connection, not only to your own tribe, but beyond, widening the scope of what constitutes love, ties, and family. It is the larger embrace.
We have a rare treat. I'd like to invite up the Converse sisters, Maylin and Tara.
Every day brings struggle. Every day brings joy. Every day brings us the opportunity to ease the struggle of another, to be the joys in another's life. May this flame remind us to carry our light to each other and to the world.
Our speaker this morning is a former UU member, and for a while is even a director of religious education here. Currently a lapsed Unitarian, a house spouse, a soccer impresario, and a college admissions consultant. Please welcome Robin Carey.
Thanks, everybody. So, how you been? It's been a while. Yeah, a couple years. Adoption ago. Not sure if there's a person in the world whose soul abides in more mortal peril than a lapsed Unitarian. So, but I like to say, when people ask me, every once in a while they ask me, hey, just go to that Unitarian place? I'm like, no, man, I got excommunicated. It was the great schism of 2005. But anyway, it's good to be back. I'm sorry Paula can't be here, because Paula was the one who kind of wrangled me into this. And
She's teaching.
She is here, though. And Paula also got Mimi to work, so now Mimi is working childcare down in the basement. So there is, sort of, life can be sort of cyclical. She was the receiver of childcare down there. Now she is the giver. I like the opening words that Penny chose. I didn't choose them because I'm kind of a slacker and a prima donna. So I'm like, nah, I can't do that. Too hard. So, but I liked especially the phrase, the larger embrace, because we began in 2002. on a quest or with a purpose of adopting a child, ultimately from Guatemala. And now we are certainly holding in our embrace, and we are being held in the embrace of a much larger family of Mimi's 5 sisters and 8 nieces and nephews and a 9th on the way. And also a stepfather or a surrogate father in Guatemala. So, and the story of how we got from there to here is a good one, and hopefully it'll be told well. It pretty much tells itself, right? So if I just get out of the way, the story should be pretty good. The timeline might be jumpy, we might go back and forth, but for this presentation, just pretend we're all Mayan, right? And the past and the future just all sort of coexist in an eternal present. And then you won't worry about continuity errors and ellipses and other things that happen when I'm kind of like a big picture person and not so much a detail person. So there, my wife Beth is on PowerPoint today, and there's actually 2 documents in there. There's one that's really nice and crisp and everything cropped correctly and looking good and well captioned, and then mine's also in there. So we might have to switch back because there is a picture in my first attempt that we might want to see. Okay. So yeah, like the opening words, the children's story. Hey, it's the best I could do. Not exactly the way I would tell the adoption story, but some people see it that way, right? I don't think there are kids in Guatemala dreaming of white folks coming to take them home, but you know, a lot of people do. For a lot of people, adoption has a religious meaning to it, and they do believe there's divine intervention and that kind of stuff. You know, it wasn't quite the way we approached it, but one thing I've learned, and I think this is part of the message here, is that, you know, there's not a perfect, I looked for a lot of books, I went through a lot of books, and I had to have Mimi vet the books for me, ask her if it was okay to read. She's like, yeah, that one's not as weird as the other one, so it's okay. So that one was okay, but there's no perfect book, right? And one thing that we've learned by being adoptive parents and then having 2 bio babes of our own is, you know, there's not a perfect parent, and there's not a perfect adoption situation. And so we've really come to embrace the imperfection of parenting adopted children and children in general, right? Seems like just every day or every week there's just some fresh nonsense or some crisis or drama that we're always sort of trying to pour water on, and we just keep making mistake after mistake and just kind of wondering. And then we just keep going. We know now, we've sort of accepted that, you know, this is what it is. We made a commitment to a kid all those years ago, 13 years ago, 14 years ago, and just doing the best we can to get her through. So, and I've always, you know, it keeps you humble if, you think that it's, part of the job of raising children is helping them overcome the stigma of having parents. So that's kind of how we approach it sometimes, but sometimes we forget. Okay. But most adoptions in Guatemala usually happen because something went wrong somewhere along the way. It could be war, it could be poverty, injustice, economic inequalities, all kinds of conditions. I mean, you don't have to search beyond to find the reasons for adoption. There's plenty of earthly reasons why adoptions happen. We happen to be privileged enough to, you know, be able to adopt, to be able to afford the process, to go through all the paperwork and rigmarole. I'm looking for I've got my visual aids here. Adoption dossier paperwork that we filled out all those years ago. Everything notarized, things like that. Oh, just drop that there. Yep. So, So we were really fortunate. Other people aren't so fortunate. Mothers who want to keep their children aren't able to keep them. It's not always so clear cut. There's a book that I did a lot of research for this, or just did a lot of reading. Beth is wiser than I, and she's not like reading all this stuff. Like, Beth, you gotta read this. No, I don't. So, I live this every day. All right, so here's a book called Daddy Come Get Me, and this is really sort of very Christian perspective, like God wanted us to have this child. And so a little hard to get through, but that's kind of one perspective. But, you know, we wanted to be different kind of adoptive parents. We wanted to be, like, totally correct in every way and do things the right way. All right, so when we went down to Guatemala City, we didn't stay in any of the adoption hotels. It was kind of an adoption hotel, but it was, you know, didn't have a pool. So, you know, we were kind of roughing it. It was down by the embassy. In Guatemala City, there's a zone called the Zona Viva, which is, you know how to translate that. It's kind of where the tourists go. That's where the nightlife is, so to speak. And that's where a lot of adoptive families sort of hold up while they were either visiting or just waiting for their children, especially the Marriott. There's also the Radisson, there's the Westin. And so we thought we were too cool for that. So we went down the other end of, away from the Zona Viva, down by the embassy in Casa Grande, or was it Casablanca? Anyway, it's just a small, very simple hotel. So we didn't change your name. That's a choice that some families make, to change the name, to give them a new name. Maybe there's a family name they like, they want to give to their kid. And so that happens, and, you know, there's no judgments there. For us, we liked her name. It kind of fit in with the sort of Old Testament theme we had going on, because we had a Jonah, we had an Ezra, and now we have a Miriam. So, like, perfect. That didn't mean that, you know, it was fate or anything like that. We always intended to find her birth family. We knew we were going to make contact with them. Open adoption, internationally, not so much a thing. We do know one family that did. They insisted when they went through their adoption that it be open. And I don't know how they got the lawyer and the notary and everybody down in Guatemala to agree to it, but they did. And their adoption was open from the beginning. So there was early contacts with the birth family. And we were just, like, so impressed with them, right? What a great thing to do. But, you know, life is complicated, and that relationship, now the child, adopted child, doesn't really keep in touch with the parents so much, with the family so much. It's hard, right? And so for us, we didn't start our search till much later, and as I'll tell you, if I don't run out of time, you know, it was a long, drawn-out process, just because, again, I'm kind of like a big-picture person, and, like, didn't, there's some details that, you know, needed to be taken care of. So we joined the local Guatemalan adoption group. You know, if you may recall, in the late 90s, after the end of the Civil War in 1996, and between 96 and 2007, there was a spike in Guatemalan adoption, so, especially in the early 2000s. 2003 is the year that Mimi came to Madison, and adoptions in Guatemala peaked in 2007. And then they were cut off completely in 2008. Guatemalan's adoption system, one of the reasons why adoptions were so prevalent in Guatemala is because it was one of the few private adoption systems left, where adoptions were handled by lawyers and notaries, and not by the government. The government had to sign off, and the government had to inspect the papers and DNA test and all that stuff, but it was really sort of a private system. Which one writer said about the Guatemalan adoption system, you know, when it's good, it's the best adoption system there is. When it's bad, it's the worst. Because there were definitely abuses. Mm-hmm. And when money enters into this relationship, there's a lot of money that circulates through that system, through the adoption system, coming from adoptive parents and lawyers in Guatemala, and there are people out trying to, now there's a market for people trying to find babies in Guatemala, and that was going on, and, you know, is this baby really an orphan? Is this baby really been relinquished? And so there was a lot of abuse, and UNICEF has always been strictly against international adoption, and there was a convention passed at the UN, the Hague Convention, that Guatemala was non-compliant with, and the U.S. didn't really care about so much. And as soon as Guatemala began to come into compliance with the Hague Convention, that was it. Private adoptions couldn't happen anymore. One of the books that I looked at when I was kind of researching and reading for this presentation is this kind of thick thing called U.S. Embassy Cables, Adoption Fraud in Guatemala from 1987-2010. And this is actually just... it's just cables. There's no commentary. There's no introduction. There's no foreword. There's nothing. It's just sort of cables about some adoption cases. And some of them, there's a suspicion of fraud. And some, there's, you can see more clear-cut stuff. But finally, in 2008, the Guatemalan government shut down international adoptions. And now there just are no longer any adoptions from Guatemala. And now, so now Guatemala is dealing with the consequences of that, which are hard, right? Because there are orphans in Guatemala and there aren't enough families to take orphans. So there are orphanages, and I don't know if any of you heard about the fire at an orphanage earlier this year in Guatemala City. It's an orphanage for girls in the city, and they were overcrowded. They were in violation of fire codes. There are fire codes in Guatemala City, and there was And the girls weren't being treated well, and there was a fire, and there were multiple fatalities in that fire. So, but Guatemala, I mean, a lot of people in Guatemala are trying to make the domestic adoption work in Guatemala, but there's probably more orphans than there are places to put them or families for them. Okay. So we were trying to do everything the right way, but... you know, life in general and children in particular have a way of mocking your best intentions. I don't know if you guys recall that Prairie had a pretty prominent place during this period when we were trying to adopt, because I was still a member in good standing and I hadn't been excommunicated yet. As we were assembling the materials for our dossier, we had to get letters of reference, and Randy Converse wrote one that was so fulsome in its praise that it really just makes me blush. I went back and read all... it's really hard to read references that people wrote for you 13 years ago and say, like, wow, who's that? Who's that person? But Randy wrote a great one. The very first picture taken of Mimi, I believe, was by Bob Park. So this was Mimi's Gotcha Day, and that's the day that a lot of adoptive families celebrate, that when you went to the embassy, or Beth went to the embassy in this case, and the adoption was final and they were brought home, was September 10th, 2003. The retreat at Bethel Horizons was September 11th, September 12th, 2003. So Mimi came home, she got off the plane pretty freshly jet lagged, and we schlepped her off to Bethel Horizons. And so that's where she sort of had her coming out, was at the Prairie Retreat in 2003. And Bob took a bunch of pictures, and he sent them out to everybody who was on the list, I guess. I still have that email from September 12th, 2003. And if you go to the bad PowerPoint presentation, go to the bad one. There is a picture of Mimi fast asleep on Judy Skog's shoulder. There it is. And of course, Mimi was pretty much raised by the Converse family, partially. Though Tara was one of her first babysitters. Then when Tara went off to college, having made an excellent choice of colleges, Maylene took over. And Maylene and Mimi are like sisters now. And everybody's still kind of raising Mimi. The last month I had to go to Florida for some family stuff. And Mimi goes to a school that's on the northeast side. She goes to Shabazz, so she's not a west, this is walking distance, so there's always transportation. Like, how do we get her there and back? So the whole Converse family and me and Beth were in on this group message, like, okay, so who's taking Mimi to school and who's getting Mimi from school, right? So, you know, Prairie has been, you know, pretty important about that, even though I haven't been around Prairie for a while. I mentioned the dossier list, and I guess I probably won't spend too much time on it, but you can see from all the documents, the stuff that we had to pull together, besides reference, letters of reference, our birth certificates, our marriage certificate, the home study from the social worker, health certificates, certifying we're in good health, police clearance, certification of no record of child abuse, employment letter, that wouldn't apply to me, bank letter, two affidavits from people, two letters of recommendation, immigration letter of approval, copies of the inside cover of both adoptive parents' passport, name affidavit just to demonstrate that your name is actually your name, photographs, and the check. Oh, wait, there's more. Nope, that's it. So it took us many months to pull all this together and get it together. And everything that was notarized also had to be certified after it was notarized by the Secretary of State. So Secretaries of State of Illinois and Wisconsin had to sign off on the notaries. And if the notaries somehow had let their license or whatever notaries have expire, then your dossier is kicked out of family court or kicked out in Guatemala. So it took a long time. So we got Mimi's referral in October of 2002, right around her first birthday. She had just had her first birthday down in Guatemala. And then she finally came home September 10th of 2003. So about a year, 11 months or so. And there were just, you know, delays along the way. And 2003 was a time when the Guatemalan authorities were really starting to look closely at adoption. And in the middle of 2003, there was just a stop, just a freeze, a hold for a couple months. And you don't really get a whole lot of explanation about it. Just say it's, you know, we're being held. And then if you get close to the festive season, then just forget it. In Guatemala, everything shuts down from December 15th to January 10th, 15th, nothing. So that, you know, you just have to wait. Okay. All right, so this is the part of the presentation where I hope I don't lose it, because some emotional stuff. The story, I mean, really begins with Mimi's mother, Zoila del Carmen Molina. She was born in El Salvador, November 20th, 1971. Zoila's father left shortly after she was born. So Zoila took her mother's name, her mother's full name, the name that Mimi also has. Zoila's mother was Lydia del Carmen Molina. If you recall, this in early 1980s, so when Zoila was 10, this is 1981, you'll recall there was a civil war also in El Salvador, largely funded by the US, death squads roaming around. And Lydia brought Zoila to Guatemala City to get her away from the civil war. Of course, there was a civil war in Guatemala, too. It was starting to wind down around 81. It was still going in 81. But in Guatemala City, not as bad as out in the countryside in the highlands. Shortly after Lydia brought Zoila to Guatemala City, she returned to El Salvador, leaving Zoila in the care of a sister. I'm not sure, but it appears from the story that we've been pieced together, Zoila didn't really ever go to school. She went to work right away. And she was working at a sort of bar, restaurant type thing in a condition that was, you know, pretty much close to indentured servitude. Until she met, when she was 16 years old, Marcos Antulio Alonso Gonzalez. And Marcos got her away from that place. And Zoila and Marcos had five daughters. These are Mimi's sisters. Lydia, Maida, Nancy, Vicky, and Jasmine. Currently, they're all between the ages of 18 and 28. Lydia, the oldest, is 28. And Jasmine, the closest in age, who Jasmine is also called Mimi, is 18. And we knew that they existed. We knew that Mimi had sisters because the adoption papers, a social worker's report from Guatemala that Zoila had to fill out or to interview for, indicated. We knew the sisters were there and their ages were all there back then. And we knew their full names and all that. And when I was putting together the materials for the search, when we were about to hire the searcher, Mimi and I went through all the documents, and Mimi wrote down the names of all her sisters because she was trying to learn all their names. Because it's pretty complicated, right? The five of them, their ages, they all have long names. So we knew they existed, but we didn't really know where they were because Zoila was Salvadoran, and the social worker's report that we read in the adoption papers said that Marcos had left Zoila alone with the five girls. And so we didn't know if maybe, we knew that Zoila's mom had gone back to El Salvador, so maybe Zoila had gone back, and then maybe she had taken some of the girls, or maybe she had sent some of the girls to their grandmother in El Salvador. So when we were getting ready to search, we didn't really know exactly where the search was going to lead. The social worker's report turned out, there's a lot of things that are accurate in it. And the paper, it's a pretty transparent adoption, except for just a couple details in the social worker's report that weren't quite accurate. It was actually Zoila who left Marcos. And Marcos stayed home, was now at home with five daughters in various ages. I guess this would have been when Jasmine was one, so Lydia was 11 or 12. And so here's Marcos at home with five girls, and he's not quite sure what to do. So Mimi's sister Maida decided to quit school, stay home, and raise the younger girls. And we didn't learn this until the search was complete, until they found the sisters. We had always intended to go back, always intended to make contact with Mimi's birth mother, with her family. About 9 months after Mimi came to Madison, we sent a letter to Zoila, just to give her like a heads up, just to tell her how Mimi was doing, how things were going, and that kind of stuff. In preparing for this presentation, I found the letter. I found the Spanish translation. A colleague at Beth's translated it into Spanish, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. My Spanish, thankfully, now is good enough that I can understand it. But we basically said that, you know, we were happy to add Mimi to our family. She's enjoying. She likes her brothers, 5 and 8 years old. She's got lots of friends and neighbors who care for her and love her. She's intelligent, brave, very curious, but a little bit of a risk taker. She's always climbing on something. She's got lots of bruises and scratches, but generally she's in good health. So one of the reasons that Zoila decided that, so Zoila tried to keep Mimi. Mimi was with her for 8 months. And one of the reasons why Zoila decided to put Mimi up for adoption is because Mimi got very ill in Guatemala. She had some skin infections that were pretty bad. And Zoila was really worried about her health and worried about the cost of medicine, that whether she could afford medicine to cure. And that's a very common and kind of tragic reason for a lot of adoptions, where a few bucks worth of medicine, 20, 40, 60 bucks worth of medicine, would probably keep a child with their family. Mimi's sisters remember Mimi from when she was a baby, because Zoila brought Mimi to live for a while with Marcos and her sisters, and they were helping take care of her. And what happened is, as it turns out, as we found out when the searcher found her family, that one day Marcos and the girls came home from church. It was a Sunday. Mimi had been there, and Mimi was gone. And they asked Zoila, they said, where did Mimi go? And Zoila told them that she had taken Mimi to live with her father's people, with her father's relatives, parents. So they said, okay, but the girls never stopped asking for her. And so Mimi's sisters did not realize that she was adopted until the searcher showed up one day in their neighborhood and said, I have a letter for Zoila del Carmen Molina. Bye, Mimi. She knows most of this. Okay, she doesn't know everything though. There's stuff that's we're holding back. Some stuff that when she's a little older, she can understand. So we sent the letter through the lawyer, the same lawyer that had conducted the adoption, and we don't know if she ever got the letter or not. And there were pictures that went with it, and we don't know. And so just yesterday, I messaged Mimi's sisters, the older ones. I said, I just found a letter that I sent to your mother when Mimi was 3. Do you remember a letter or any pictures? And of course, they wouldn't have seen the letter because the letter would have indicated that Mimi was adopted. And so the oldest, Lydia, so, you know, who would have been 12 or 13 at the time, or no, 15, said, yeah, I kind of vaguely remember some pictures, but I don't think there was a letter. So I scanned, it's kind of weird now that now I'm scanning documents and sending them to her family. But I scanned the letter and sent it off to them yesterday. I suspect that the adoption attorney, once the adoption was complete, probably didn't really have much more to do with it. So I'm not sure if the stuff got there or not. So the rough outline of the adoption search, or the timeline, we always knew that there was an adoption searcher out there named Susie. A lot of other Guatemalan adoptive families had used her. We went to a meeting, I think, about how to search for your child's birth family or birth parents, and we came away with a spreadsheet that had the names of different searchers and their contact information and what they charge and where they go and the kind of stuff they do and all that stuff. And so I stuffed that into a desk drawer for a while and then just didn't pull it out until sometime during the course of 2012, so about 5 years ago. Then the clock starts ticking, the timeline begins. Starts with an email of January 7th, 2013. How am I doing on time? Am I okay? I don't want to.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This is from me to Susie. And in our house, Susie just became known as Susie Searcher. Mimi, I'm talking with Susie Searcher. Okay. All right. We have an 11-year-old daughter who was adopted from Guatemala when she was 2. She is very interested in learning more about her birth mother, and some other adoptive parents in Madison, Wisconsin recommend you as someone who might be able to help. If you were still doing birth mother searches, we would be interested in learning more. Thank you very much. Response 3 weeks later, January 29th. I apologize, from Susie. I apologize for the delay in answering your email. I had minor eye surgery, but I'm back to work. I'm happy to help. I am attaching the transcript, an interview I did, and some information about the search. The cost of a search in Guatemala City is $850. If any traveling is involved, my charges are $200 per day for a maximum of 4 days. There's a different fee for international searches because we thought this was going to El Salvador, quite possibly. And also places some area, dangerous areas in the highlands, in indigenous areas. I've done searches everywhere, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua. All we had to do was pretty much do what we did for the adoption, is put together all her papers and send them all down. So we had to email or courier or scan them and send the adoption papers, the social work report, things that indicate what her address might be, where Zoila might be currently living. And that took about 2.5 years. Not sure why, really, just kind of entropy or lassitude or something like that. Just, you know, had these emails. I'd asked her to send me back an address where I could just courier the documents, and I didn't get a reply for a long time. So it just kind of went on and on and on. We never really took the next step to get the documents together, either scan them and send them down. So about 2.5 years passed until this email, May 12th, 2015. Can't believe it's been 2.5 years since I started this conversation. If you're still doing searches and can send me your address, I would like to initiate a search for Miriam's birth mother. No response from Susie until December 8th, 2015. So on both ends, we're just kind of dragging the process out a bit. So this is December 2015. So less than 2 years ago. Yes, I'm still doing birth mother searches. Finally, on January 2nd, 2016, almost 3 years to the day since I first contacted Susie, I scanned all of her documents. The 3 years of lost time would be pretty crucial, it turns out. Dear Susie, attached to Miriam's adoption papers and some other items that could be helpful in Mimi's birth mother search. Please let me know when you receive them. Susie required Mimi to write a letter to her mother and for us to send 10 pictures sort of over the span of her life from different ages in her life. Those were sent January 26th, 2016. Also required a wire in the 3 years or 2.5 years that I sort of dickered. The price had gone up from $850 to $1,000. She required a wire transfer of $1,000, which arrived February 2nd. So now the search was active, February 2nd, 2006. 16, sorry about that, thank you. 8 days later, I receive an email from Susie. Hi, Robin. I found Mimi's birthday family yesterday. It took her 8 days. All right, it took me 3 years to pull it all together. And Susie went out, and she found them in 8 days because they had never left Guatemala City. They were always there. The family was there the entire time because they hadn't. They were living with Marcos. They weren't living with Zoila. And Marcos is from Guatemala City. So they were there. So she did have to go to a couple addresses. So there were two addresses in the social worker's report. She went to the first address, and she said a woman there remembered Zoila. And she mentioned that Zoila's daughters live in Zone 6. Barrio San Antonio, kind of a dangerous part of Guatemala City. In Guatemala City, there are lots of no-go zones. They're called red zones, where you're really not supposed to go, where crime is high. It's super dangerous. There's 25 zones in Guatemala City, although a couple really don't exist. You can't find them. But Zone 6 is one of the most dangerous. Zone 18, where Zoila had lived, is one of the more dangerous, too. But Susie went to the place in Zone 6, and she reports this. The street that they gave me, 14 Calle, has a dead end, but some very poor houses extend beyond down the ravine. I approached a group of three women, and I asked for Zoila Carmen del Carmen Molina. One of them said, "She is my mother." I asked the young girl, this is Maida, who's the second oldest, if we could speak more privately, and she brought me to her home. On the way, I told her about the envelope from U.S. for Zoila. We sat down, and Maida said that her mother lives in the street, alongside the railroad tracks on Calzada Atanasio Tzul. Her mother cannot live in an enclosed space, and that she and her sisters have brought her to live with them several times, but after a few days, she leaves. She asked who the sender of the letter was, and when I said Maria del Carmen, she said, "She is my sister." Because she knew of Mimi, and because Mimi on her letter mentioned her wish to know about her sisters, I answered yes. Susie continues, "I opened the envelope and handed her the pictures one by one, saying that Mimi lives in the U.S. with her adoptive family. This was a surprise to Maida, who was now openly crying, because her mother had told them that Miriam del Carmen lives with her grandmother on her father's side. They did not know that Mimi had been adopted. Maida's husband, Eswin, there he is, right, who was present all the time, went to call her sisters. Nancy Karina arrived first, and she had the same reaction as Maida. She exploded into tears once Maida explained that the girl in the pictures was Mimi. About 15 minutes later, Vicky arrived. That's Nancy and her husband, Byron, and Flor, and Leslie. Vicky also cried for a long time. They all agreed that Mimi is beautiful. Maida asked if she was all right because she still remembers that Mimi was very sick. She remembers her mother was very concerned about Mimi's health, and this was the reason she parted from Mimi. At Maida and her father's insistence, Zoila brought Mimi to live with them for a short period of time. Maida remembers that upon their return from church one day, as I said, they found that their mother had left. Next time they saw Zoila, they had asked for Mimi, and this is when she told them that she was under the care of Jaime Rodolfo's mother. Susie asked the girls to tell a little bit about their mother's life story, and I told you a little bit about it. She was brought to Guatemala City from El Salvador when she was 10. So I talked a little bit about corruption in Guatemala adoptions, and in Mimi's own family, it touched them because Mimi's sisters, Vicky and Jasmine, were stolen and placed for adoption by some woman. Sometime during this timeline in the 2000s, the story that Susie reported to me was that there was a woman who was in love with Marcos, but Marcos didn't pay any attention to her. So to take revenge, she stole Vicky and Jasmine and took them to a place where they would be adopted. But Marcos went to get them. He found them. And he tried to get them back, but the government wouldn't let him take them back, and they stayed at a state children's home for 3 years. And so Marcos would go to visit them in home, and he finally got them back after 3 years. Well, Marcos is a great guy. So when our first phone call down there, Beth called them, I guess, in March or April of 2016, after we had found them. Marcos was just sort of beside himself in tears, and he was crying over the phone. And he's not her natural father, but he remembers her from when she was there. So he took care of all those girls when they were growing up. Girls stayed 3 years in the state children's home. Then she goes on to say, Mimi's sisters would love to have a relationship with her and to see her and meet her in November. We were planning to go in November, but it does not seem possible to have a direct relationship with Zoila. Maida promised to go and try and locate her mom as soon as possible to bring her the good news that Mimi is loved and well. Okay. So I've said a bit about all the sisters already, and you've seen pictures. We started to talk to the sisters. We'd call down there. Most of them have phones, and we would call and we would talk to them. Mimi doesn't speak any Spanish, so it was pretty much Beth talking to the entire family, and that is not easy, right? There's a lot of emotion going on, and she's on the phone. You can't see their faces. So we talked to them a couple times, then we started to plan for the visit. So this is February, March. We're thinking we're going to come down in October, November. That's when Guatemalan kids are off of school. During that time, this email arrived from Susie. Dear Robin and Beth, Maida's father just called to let us know that Zoila passed away today. He said she was hospitalized a week ago at San Juan de Dios Hospital in Guatemala City. After the initial medical checkup, the doctor told her that Zoila had tuberculosis and pneumonia and she would not survive. Maida's father does not want Mimi to know, but I told her I would pass the news on to you and that you were to take the decision. He said he understood. Deeply sorry for Mimi's near loss. Warm regards, Susie. It's a little hard to deal with the fact that there were 2 or 3 years in there where we could have initiated a relationship with Mimi's mother, or maybe not, because she was not doing well. And as, I don't know, the initial report was that it would be difficult because she wasn't really living at a fixed address, but still, 2 or 3 years earlier, and something might have happened. Maida did find Zoila. Zoila saw the pictures. She saw the letter. She read the letter that Mimi sent, and she was glad to hear that Mimi was doing well. Mimi's sisters confronted Zoila with the fact that she had not told them about the adoption, and Zoila told them that she just wanted Mimi to be well and with a good family and safe, and that's why she did it. So we arranged to visit them, and the first visit was at the end of October 2016. We went down for 4 days, sort of a quick visit. And the initial meeting, it was all facilitated by Susie's organization, which is called Asociación de Familia a Familia. And this is an organization in Guatemala, a nonprofit, and it also has an office in Miami, that connects adoptive families mm-hmm. with birth families. And they've connected about 225 families. And in addition to the birth searches, which is kind of Susie's sort of side project, they coordinate assistance for Guatemalan birth families in terms of education, nutrition, ecological stoves, and technical training. So they make it possible for birth families in the state to support, adoptive families in the state to support birth families in Guatemala. And Cecilia, one of the contacts there said that they have about 225 families that they work with. So we were just one of them. So they had done these visits, they coordinated these first visits for a lot of families, and so they knew exactly what to do when we were coming down. They said, we're gonna meet at the zoo. There's 8 kids, right? There's 5 sisters, there's a bunch of spouses, and there's Marcos, and there's you guys, and there's 8 kids, we're meeting at the zoo. So we met them at the zoo, and Maida was the first one to approach Mimi, because Maida is sort of in charge, it seems, a lot of the time. And the first thing she said to Mimi is, I'm sorry, my mother said that she didn't give you up for adoption because she didn't love you. She did it because she loved you, and she wanted you to be safe and healthy. You'll see there's not a picture of Zoila here. We have them, but I had to run all this by Mimi before the presentation to ask her what I could say, what I couldn't say, what I could show, what I couldn't show, and that's where the line is drawn for now, right? It's very private for her. So we met with the family at the zoo, and we hung around in the zoo. It was a great location, a great venue for the reunion. It was super easy. The kids ran around, and they went on rides and trains, and then we ate lunch at the Pollo Campero, which is the Guatemalan chicken chain, at the zoo. And then Mimi's sisters made the mistake of going on rides right after lunch. So I don't think they've done a lot of that stuff. And they were supposed to go in the bumper cars, but, you know, there are six sisters and, like, three bumper cars. So Mimi's like, let's go on this ride over here. It's one of those things that goes up and down and round and round. Yes. So afterwards, Mimi's sisters turn various shades of green and just puke their guts out in the at the zoo. Like, yeah, nice, first meeting. So that was, we went to the zoo, so then we went back to our hotel, and so the next day, and the hotel that we now stay at is the former Marriott, right? It's not the Marriott anymore, it's now a Barceló, it's a Spanish hotel. And so the next day we met again at Pollo Campero for breakfast, because that's where you go, right? So like the McDonald's of Guatemala. And then we went to the cemetery. And this was late October, so a couple days before Day of the Dead. So the whole country is preparing for Day of the Dead. The Catholic cemetery is super clean and cleaned up and white and scrubbed down. And the Mayan cemetery is super colorful, lots of colors and stuff. And for transportation, they had a friend who's a priest, and he brought this red truck. So we had to walk from the Pollo Campero and basically wait on a traffic island in the middle of Guatemala City with cars whizzing by, waiting for the truck to arrive. And I think the guy was a priest. We saw him the first time. Didn't see him the second time. All right, so in the cab, there's room for like five people maybe. So obviously, Beth and I, the gringos, get in the cab. And Vicky gets in the cab with her little baby Mia, who is barely one, and then everybody else in the back. And we're kind of these overprotective American parents, and we're like, really, can Mimi ride back there? But we knew it was the right thing to do to let her ride in the back of the truck with her sister. So we were tooling around in Guatemala City in this red truck. And then we headed to the cemetery where Zoila is buried. So when you get to the cemetery, you have to slow down because there's lots of people there. We parked. We walked out to the vaults where she was kept. And all the girls went to Zoila's vault. And they're stacked like four or five stories high. And Beth and I sort of hung back, and so Mimi and her sisters just stood there at Zoila's vault. It was good that we got to go to the cemetery. And then from there, we ended up going to a park, like a big sort of soccer stadium type place where just people just come and run around. And that was pretty much the first visit. So we decided we would be back. We weren't exactly sure when. We made plans to go back this past summer. We're going to go back. And then in the spring, or early in the spring, in the winter, Maida decided she was going to get married. So Maida and Eswin already, they had three children, but they had a civil union. They didn't have a marriage. In Guatemala, if you're with a partner for 3 years, you can form a legal union, right? And that supposed to protect the children in case of death or dissolution of the relationship. So all of her Mimi's sisters were in unions, and none of them in church that had not been married in the church. So Maida decided that she was going to get married in the church. So now we had a wedding to go to. So we went to the wedding, and so we decided the wedding was important enough, and Maida really wanted, because Mimi's brothers Jonah and Ezra did not go to the first visit, and Maida really wanted them to come. She really wanted to meet the whole family. And Mimi really wanted the boys to go. So the whole family went to Guatemala City. Right after school was out. So in The wedding was June 17th. So there's the three of them waiting outside the hotel in Guatemala City for Marcos to send his people to pick us up to go to the wedding. So the wedding's at 5 o'clock, right? So there's this thing called in Guatemala called Hora Chapina. So Chapina is a sort of a, it's a term for Guatemala. So Guatemalans call themselves, it's sort of a term of honor. They like to refer to themselves as Chapinas. All right, Hora Chapina means Guatemalan time, right? So everything's not on time. So Marcos says, all right, I've got a guy. He's going to come and get you at 3 o'clock. So just wait at 3 o'clock and bring you the way. Wedding's at 5, right? So we're like, oh, wow, lots of time. Those of you who are on Facebook saw this picture on Facebook. I took it while we were waiting. So 3 o'clock, 3:30, 3:45, 4 o'clock. All right, now I'm starting to worry a little bit. Like, okay, they're not coming. I don't think we're trying to text Marcos or Lydia or anybody or Mitre or anybody. They've got, you know, we know how to reach them now. And we can't get anybody, so we're like, okay, at 4:15 or something like that, we're just going to cab it. We're going to get in a cab. But the address was weird. Right? The address that Mitre had given us for the church, I had Google mapped it already. I'm like, no, it didn't come up. So, and the first cab driver we got, the first in line, we gave him the address. He's like, nope, don't know where that is, not going there. So I went inside, I got the woman at the front desk of the hotel, and she knew where this place was. She knew basically where it was. So she came out, the next cab driver came up, and she just kind of explained to him where the place was, and he's like, oh, okay. So we all got in, five people in a cab that was not big enough for five people. Mimi was always on somebody's lap or something. And we start heading off to the wedding, which was in another zone of the city. I think it was in zone 6. Took a long time, a lot of traffic in Guatemala City, took a long time to get there. The cab driver, the directions now are useless, right? He's gotten to the end of the directions and we're still not there and doesn't really know where to get there. Luckily, Beth gets Lydia on the phone, hands the phone to the cab driver, and Lydia talks the cab driver to the place. So we're approaching this place and it's Guatemala City. We know it's gonna be rough, right? It's not gonna be, you know, super safe or anything like that, but kids are dressed pretty nicely, right? They're pretty well turned out. And the neighborhood starts to turn a little bit dodgier than even sort of other neighborhoods we're in. And I'm like, all right, kids, take off your coats, right? You know, just try to look more casual. Like, so here I am trying to tell my 5'10" blonde, blue-eyed haired kid, like, just blend in. So we get out of the cab, you know, we're trying to look like we belong there. But the church is there. It's not really a church. We were looking for a church, and so Lydia had to explain, it's not really a church, it's a storefront, right? Because this is not the Catholic Church any longer. They'd left the Catholic Church maybe within the few months that we, I don't know, because there was a priest at the first visit, and then the second visit, there was a pastor who's also a part-time Uber driver, and it was a storefront church. So it's now they're part of the evangelical church. So it was an evangelical church, and they say it's Christiana. They call it Christiana. So not Catholica, but Christiana. And it really is just a storefront church, the kind of evangelical church you might find around here. But it was full of people. And we sat for the wedding. We were there for the wedding. It was a long wedding. The pastor talked for a long time and said many things that were wonderful and poorly understood by me. But it was entertaining. I told him afterwards when we were sitting, I said, I've been to a lot of presentations, a lot of talks where I've understood more and enjoyed them a lot less. And he did a great job. Everybody was laughing. And so then they were married. And it was kind of amazing that we were at Mimi's sister's wedding. So now apparently it's becoming a thing, because now Lydia, the oldest, is saying she's going to get married. But I don't think we're going to make it to that one. She's set her date for December 2nd, and because she said that's the only time they can get the church, and we can't make it down December 2nd, but there's going to be another wedding in the family. So So now we have this relationship with Mimi's family. I'm on Facebook with them, messaging with them like, I don't know, three times a week. They're just checking in. How's Mimi? Mimi doesn't have a smartphone or a computer. She doesn't have ready access to social media and that kind of stuff. It's kind of a thing of ours. And so they're often checking in with me to see how she is. Every once in a while, you know, I give her the phone or I give her the computer and she can talk with them. And it's really, really weird to go from having no picture of these people in your head, not even being able to imagine ever knowing them, to kind of like ignoring their memes that they post on Facebook. Like, what's that? That's some really religious stuff. We're just going to, you know. But also we talk about real stuff too, just, you know, the logistics of their lives in Guatemala and how things can help, how, you know, things can be better and stuff like that. So all their kids, they've got their, three of their kids are starting school, and next weekend, in coordinated by AFF, by Association de Familia, Maida and Nancy are going to a seminar in Antigua to learn how to weave, to make plastic baskets and sell them in the market. So this technical training is part of what AFF does to try to address the reasons why people are adopted in the first place and address poverty in Guatemala. So Maida and Nancy are going to do that. Lydia is now talking about going back to school. She went to school longest. She wants to take some accounting courses, and she thinks she wants to work in a bank one day. And we're, you know, sort of helping them a little bit with that kind of stuff. We plan to go back maybe this summer. I have this great fantasy of Mimi spending 4 weeks in language school in Antigua this summer, but I don't know if that's going to happen because she's still not studying Spanish very much. But now we have this wider embrace of this family. This family has merged with our family for the most part. Mimi and her five sisters and Marcos and eight nieces and nephews and a ninth on the way. Yeah, it's been kind of a remarkable story. Some regrets along the way. I wish it happened earlier. I wish we had gone faster a little bit. A lot of people think that Mimi is really, really fortunate to have been adopted, to be in the States, to have a family that has means and things, but it's just not that easy, right? And so one of the things we do when we go down there is that AFF provides facilitators and translators that we can just sit for 4 hours and talk with them. They can ask questions of us, we can ask questions of them. So we did that this last time. Beth and the boys had already gone home. Mimi and I stayed there for 2 weeks. And so after they had gone home, we had this meeting. Social worker comes, and we all sit around for 4 hours. And it's a little bit awkward, right? So it's like, ready, set, talk. Ask your questions. So Mimi's like, what do I ask? And her sisters are like, I don't know what to say. So we talked about some stuff. But there's a lot of stuff left to say to them, I think. It doesn't all have to be said at one time. But there are things to be said. I want them to understand how difficult it is for Mimi, how hard it is to be an adopted child. You know, we can do a lot for her. We can give her a lot of stuff. We can give her a lot of opportunities, right? But she can't really see herself in us, right? For that, she really needs them. And there's definitely still just this piece, this hole there that we can't fill, right? And so we're doing what we can. There's a quote from Elizabeth Larson, who wrote an article called "Did I Steal My Baby?" Because a lot of adoptive parents have these sort of same thoughts, like, was what we did the right thing to do? And I don't really know if what we did was right. We're just doing it. So Elizabeth Larson says, to most Americans, adoption is measured entirely by what the child gains. Montessori schools, soccer camps, piano lessons, college. But it no longer quite computes for me that way for me. To gain a family, my daughter had to lose a family. To become an American child, she had to stop being a Guatemalan child. Well, Mimi has missed out on a Guatemalan childhood, so now we're engaged in the work of giving her the option of having a Guatemalan future. The door is open to her, and we're trying to equip her to walk through it. Thank you.
Closing words. The United States adopts more children internationally, but also domestically, than the rest of the world combined. The good, the bad, and the ugly all play out here in bigger ways than they do elsewhere, simply because the process is older and more developed here, for better or worse. That's Adam Pertman, Executive Director of the Donaldson Adoption Institute and author of Adoption Nation. That's our service for today. Greet your neighbors, stay for Soup Sunday, and that's it.